Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Performing Arts, a podcast from the New Books Network. My name is Andy Boyd. Today, I have the great pleasure to be speaking with Richard Thompson, author of the memoir Bee's Wing, Losing My Way and Finding My Voice, 1967 to 1975. Richard, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Andy.
So I'd love to kind of hear a bit about the process behind writing this memoir. You've been a songwriter for, I don't know, 50 years. And you, what made you decide to kind of tell your story in a different way through prose?
I think I was interested to challenge myself to see if I could write something with a bit more discipline, something that took a bit longer. But it's also, it's a period that people have asked me about a lot, the 60s into the 70s. So I thought it was time before... before I get too old to remember, to actually write it down and add my voice to the considerable number of other voices out there about the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, and did you check your memories against like sources from the time? Was there anything that surprised you when you went back and remembered it or researched it?
Yeah, I think, you know, it was easy to write anecdotes. Is it easy to just, to jot stuff down, the funny stuff, the tragic stuff in some cases. That was easy. Comparing notes with my contemporaries proved to be frustrating because they would remember things very differently to me. I know I'm right, so I can only think they're wrong. Also, I think all our memories are very selective, so I would remember certain things that they would have totally blanked on, and vice versa. So that was in many ways the easiest part of the process. The hard part was actually putting it into a timeline, was actually trying to nail down dates of things, and that had to rely on a lot more sources. That there are websites that claim to have every Fairport Convention gig, logged in there, which is not true. In fact, there's huge holes in that particular archive. That was the hardest thing. And we actually had to have researchers looking at dates. You think it was like the 13th century we were writing about, but actually, 50 years ago, it's amazing, the records just disappear.
Yeah, that must be a sort of strange experience having like online Fairport Convention enthusiasts claiming to remember this stuff better than you do.
Yeah, it's true. And in some cases, they actually do. Yeah.
You write quite a bit about your childhood, and I get the sense that London in the 1950s was quite different from what I, as an American, think of the 1950s as being like. What was the London of your childhood like?
It seemed to be very grey, and I think that it wasn't just because all the movies were in black and white, but it's right. A black and white world. It was post-war. Britain was very poor at that point. A lot of London was bombed, so you had big parts of the landscape missing, just piles of rubble, which as kids we loved to play on, of course. And it was a slightly depressed place, maybe because the economy wasn't so great. British industry was foundering, because we were kids, we found lots of it fun. But you know, my memories are of this kind of grey world in which we you know, enjoyed ourselves as kids. But basically, I think it wasn't until the 60s that Britain really pulled itself around and certainly became a center for youth culture.
Right. And you mentioned, you know, the London of your childhood being very gray. I think the kind of popular memory of London of the 60s is a very colorful place, kind of day glow colored.
Yeah, it really changes. I mean, first of all, you had the Beatles in sort of 62, 63, giving Britain a, you know, a shot in the arm along with, you know, the miniskirt and the E-Type Jaguar, the Avengers TV show, you know, all these things that kind of created this new swinging London, you know, sort of spirit. And then when you had the psychedelic thing happening in 66, 67 with Pink Floyd, et cetera, then it really became a bit day glow. You know, the colors really did change as they changed, you know, in America to some extent. So, yeah, and then we really felt at the age of, you know, 18 to be participants in that world.
Yeah. But I'm curious about the kind of direction you went in at that time, which was quite different from, you know, a lot of your contemporaries. Most people who start bands in 1967 are not looking at songs from the 13th century. So was British folk music a part of your childhood, or when did you kind of become interested in that style of music?
It was always something that was in the background, but it wasn't hip. You know, it wasn't something that you paid attention to. Perhaps just something that you absorbed quietly and could regurgitate at a later date. So, you know, there's a certain amount around the house for me. A lot of Scottish music got played in my house, and there were books of Scottish ballads, you know, in the house that I would delve into from time to time. And, you know, at school, you were required to learn a certain amount of British folk music, usually the cleaned up Victorian version with the naughty bits missing. And then from about the age of, well, I suppose, 15, 16, I started to hang around in folk clubs. And there you could see very good singers, very good revivalists, people like Martin Carthy, Shirley Collins, you know, singing traditional music. And that became, you know, a bigger part of the diet at that point. But still, you know, it wasn't rock and roll. Rock music was the thing that got us all excited. And it had the energy and it had the, you know, the anti-establishment pose to it. So I suppose, you know, that was our main focus. But these other things at some point did become of paramount importance by 69, I suppose, 68, 69. Mm-hmm. We started to include a lot more, you know, rocked up versions of traditional music in our repertoire.
Right. Yeah. You said the word, the energy of rock and roll. And it kind of strikes me that, you know, maybe the equation of Fairport Convention is like folk music plus energy, right? Or at least that particular kind of energy. Would you say that's kind of an accurate summary of what you were up to in that band?
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah. I think what we were trying to do was to be contemporary and to bring, you know, what we felt of it as our own music, indigenous British music, into the landscape, really. And, I think, you know, we tried to develop this hybrid music that used, you know, amplifiers, used electric guitars, basses, drums, and used some of the language of rock music and blend it with this older style. You know, and I think our intention was to create really a new music form, and also to give our British audience something that they might feel was important to them, that they might feel that was part of their tradition.
Yeah, so that's a quite well thought out sort of mission statement for the band. Was that all in place when you founded Fairport Convention when you were like 18, or is that something you kind of figured out along the way?
Well, I think we figured that aspect of it out along the way. When Fairport started, we were a thoughtful bunch of people, and we did think about the musical direction, and we didn't want to be like other bands. We didn't want to be a blues band, which was the, you know, the lingua franca of the time. We wanted to be something a little bit different, and our focus at the beginning of the band was lyrics. We loved lyrics, and we loved the fact that intelligent lyrics, thanks to people like Bob Dylan and the Byrds, were coming into popular music. So what we love to do covers by some of the great singer-songwriters of the time, people like Phil Oakes, Richard Farina. We got hold of Joni Mitchell demos before she made her first record. We got hold of the Basement Tapes, the Dylan Basement Tapes. I think we were the first ones through the door with the Basement Tapes. So that was our repertoire until we started writing our own material. And then we became writers in this kind of, you know, British folk rock style. And then, you know, a couple of years later, we really tried to embrace the traditional thing.
Yeah. A lot of your music shows a great deal of sympathy for sort of outcasts of society, you know, drunks, criminals, the very poor, the rural poor. I got the sense from your book that your childhood was, you know, pretty buttoned up. So where did that kind of sympathy for outcasts come from?
I think it just comes from listening to traditional music, which is, you know, supposedly the music of the underclass, described as such sometimes. And in which you have, descriptions of the lives of you know, peasants, beggars, thieves, and all of that implies. Also, when I was starting to hang out in folk clubs, there was a heavy, you know, socialist aspect to them. I think the people in folk clubs, the people who organized folk clubs, were very in sympathy with socialism and sympathy for the underclass. And I think that's one of the reasons that there was that connection with that music.
Yeah, that's the connection between socialism and folk music is very deep in Britain, maybe even more than in the United States. I mean, think about someone like Billy Bragg, you know, a little bit later, but certainly coming out of that same tradition, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, well, in America, you had people like Pete Seeger, people who were basically hounded by the McCarthy Commission.
Yeah, I have a question that might be just only a question that I would ask as an American, but a lot of the early part of the book takes place in the Muswell Hill neighborhood. And I'm a big fan of the Kinks record, Muswell Hillbillies, but I don't actually know anything about that neighborhood. So I feel like I don't quite get the joke. So what was Muswell Hill like at that time, the kind of mid-late 60s?
It's a leafy suburb of London. It was a separate village, probably until the 1920s, when the growth of London kind of swallowed it. So it was a recognisable town, if you like, within the London suburbs. Home to the Kinks, famously. The Kinks lived just down the road from where we used to rehearse, literally on the same street. But they had kind of moved on when we were becoming more successful. Yeah, when we turned professional, the Kinks were already living somewhere else. And I can't think of any other particular musical entities who emerged from Muswell Hill. But it's a place on the map, musically speaking.
Mm-hmm. And you also met Joe Boyd pretty early on, maybe a distant relative of mine, I'm not sure. Did he sort of help you develop your sound, your kind of signature sound as a band?
Well, Joe was great. It's hard to think of anybody else in London at that time who would have seen what Fairport were trying to do and would have sympathized with Fairport's interest in roots music, for instance. So we were very fortunate to run into Joe, or perhaps it was inevitable that we ran into Joe, because we really were on the same page. And Joe certainly pointed some things in our direction. He would lend us records, all kinds of like jazz records, folk records, world music records, to kind of whet our appetite and to increase our musical knowledge. He always encouraged us as writers. And Joe would never kind of be authoritarian about it. He'd never say, you know, you really have to record this song, you have to do this, you have to do that. He really kind of watched us and watched over us to see how we would develop by ourselves, for which I'm eternally grateful.
Yeah, and did he kind of help connect you with other kind of like-minded musicians? I know you played on at least one Nick Drake album that he produced. Was that pretty common that he would kind of take people from one band he was working with and kind of introduce them to another group?
I think with Joe, it was all about the what would work on a record, really. I think he saw in Fairport people who were adaptable, sympathetic, and would probably work okay on a recording session. I mean, of course, we knew Nick, we knew John Martin, we knew the Incredible String Band from being with Joe's management company, and also we were all on Island Records at that time. So it was a kind of a small folky world, and I think it was inevitable that we would end up to some extent on each other's records.
Did you, when you made those first couple of Fairport records, did you still think of yourselves as basically a folk band?
I don't know what we thought of ourselves as. I think we always thought of ourselves as a folk rock band. We certainly admired the Byrds, we admired the Loving Spoonful, we admired Arthur Lee's Love, the merry-go-round, but people like that are people who were, I would still categorize really as folk rocks. So, I think that's how we saw ourselves.
You also write about Jimi Hendrix sometimes jumping on stage during your sets and kind of jamming with you. What was that like? Did you learn anything about guitar or anything?
Yeah, it was intimidating to watch Jimmy and to know he was in town. Even he was definitely the most interesting and revolutionary guitar player in London at that time, and some would say, has been for the last 50 years. I think that's fair enough. I could learn things by watching Jimmy, watch how he played. He had a fairly idiosyncratic way of playing, left and right hand. And he said to me, you should raise the action on your guitar. It's a little bit too low. To get the vibrato and to get the bends, he felt it was more comfortable to have it a little higher, which is what I did, and which I've done ever since, interestingly enough.
Wow, that's so specific.
Yeah.
One of the things that I found interesting about, you mentioned this with Hendrix, but with a couple other times as well, that I think a lot of people heard Jimi Hendrix and thought, I want to figure out how to do that, or I want to figure out how I can do as close to that as I can do, given that I'm not Jimi Hendrix. And it seems like you kind of went in the other direction. You kind of said, okay, he's taken the sort of psychedelic blues thing as far as it can go. I'm going to try to figure out something completely different that I'm going to do with electric guitar. Was that a conscious choice at that time? I mean, that feels like it reflects something kind of deep about you as a musician.
I think it wasn't just Hendrix, at that time, the guitar landscape in London was everyone was playing the blues, and a few people were playing soul music, but mostly, if you're a guitar player, you were playing blues, Eric Clapton, Jeff Beck, Mick Taylor, Peter Green, all these guys were blues-based players. And I thought, it's a crowded landscape. I really need to do something a bit different. So, I tried to give myself a slightly different style, tried to have different influences, listen to more to country music, listen to classical music, and listen to more jazz, just so that I would be influenced by different things. And I think, looking back long term, I think that paid off, actually, not being another blues guitar player.
Yeah. I certainly agree with that. And I'm curious about this because you are, you're renowned as being one of the great guitar players in rock history, but you also are a very distinctive guitarist, and you're one of the few guitarists where I feel like can really do the like ripping electric guitar solo thing and also do the very intimate kind of folk style finger picking thing. Does that all feel like the same thing to you, or does that feel like it's kind of different parts of your brain?
I tend to treat electric and acoustic guitars fairly differently. For obvious reasons, if I'm playing acoustic, then I'm usually playing unaccompanied, and I have to keep some sense of rhythm going. I have to keep some sense of harmony going, even while I'm playing a solo. So that forces you into a different style, a different way of playing. And it forced me into a kind of finger style on the acoustic guitar. On the electric guitar, there are other people covering some of those bases. So you are freer to improvise. You're freer to do different things from night to night, which is also great. And I think I just developed both, you know, almost simultaneously, really. Certainly in the late 70s, when I started to do solo shows, I really had to develop that acoustic style a lot more. So that was when that really pushed on. And electric guitar has just been a kind of steady progression. And I still think of myself as a student of both instruments. You know, you have just, still a lot to learn.
Yeah.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Do you have a preference these days for kind of which style of guitar you enjoy doing more? Do you like going out and doing the solo acoustic sets, or do you like the kind of full band electric rock experience more?
Well, it's so nice to have the contrast. It's so nice to be able to do both, and to, you know, to be able to put one down and pick up the other one. It can be quite inspirational, and it stops you becoming, you know, bored or cynical about the music that you play. And I think for the audience as well, it's a nice thing that you come to town 1 year acoustic, and that then next year you bring a band, you know, and it's a whole different thing, different repertoire sometimes. Different approach, and then you can, the year after that, you come back acoustic again, and it's just you know, it changes it up for me and it changes it up for the audience.
Early on in Fairport's history, you brought on Sandy Denny, one of the great singer-songwriters of all time, to kind of be as much of a front person as Fairport Convention ever had. What was your first impression of Sandy Denny?
I think the first impression was that she was an extraordinarily good musician. she's just a great singer. We've been auditioning other singers, and Sandy came in and just blew them all out of the water. I mean, she sounded such a complete singer at the age of 21, 22. She's fully developed. She had a great interpretive skills as a singer. She really sang the song. Emotionally invested in exactly the right way from song to song. She had a great range. And on top of being a really great singer, one of the best singers I've ever heard in my life, she was also a great songwriter and, you know, and a delightful human being.
I'm curious about the decision to kind of play all of these traditional songs, given that, as you mentioned, Sandy was a great songwriter, you're a great songwriter, there were other songwriters in the band. Why did you kind of decide, you know, towards the second, third album to really mine this musical history rather than writing, you know, original songs? I mean, not rather than, but, you know.
I think it wasn't really an either or. I think we thought that we would keep writing. And also explore the traditional thing at the same time. And I think the more that we looked at the tradition, the more our writing became influenced by it. So we were writing songs that sounded more British, if you like. And I think one of the reasons that after the Legion Leaf album in 1969, the group kind of splintered at that point to some extent anyway. Sandy left and Ashley Hutchings left. What was there was a difference of opinion over how much traditional music we should be playing. And for myself and Sandy, I think we saw the Legion Leaf album as a one-off project, and that after that we would continue to have traditional songs in the repertoire, but we would also have a lot of our own composed songs in the repertoire. And I think for Ashley, he thought that this was a whole new direction he wanted to go 100% into. So he saw it much more as a band playing just solid traditional music, which is something that he did much more with his next band, which was Steel Eye Span. And the band after that was the Albion Band. So he kind of went off and did that. As long as I was in Fairport, then there was a balance between composed songs and traditional songs. And Sandy always sang some traditional songs in her shows after that point. But again, I mean, she really concentrated on her writing, as I did as well.
Yeah, I'd like to know a little bit about how playing traditional music affected your songwriting, because, you know, I think about a song like 1952 Vincent Black Lightning. That's a traditional English ballad, but it's about, you know, people who wear leather and ride motorcycles. So how did kind of playing those folk songs influence your own writing?
Well, I think in the sense, well, I think in many senses. First of all, you know, a song like Vincent is a ballad. And it's not that different from, you know, a Scottish ballad from, you know, the 18th century, say, or 17th century. It shares a lot of the same characteristics, shares some of the same language, shares some of the same kind of repetitions that you find in traditional music. And some of the same themes, you know, the outlaw, the underdog, who becomes a romantic figure, if you like. You know, also melodically, structurally, there are similarities with traditional music. Just melodically, I think that's been a huge influence on my writing. I think I write stuff that sounds much more British. And of course, there are overlaps with American music. If you think of the Appalachian music as being quite Scottish sounding, quite Scottish pentatonic sounding. And then that becomes an influence on country music. So country music is very pentatonic. So you can take a song like Vincent Black Lightning, and I can do this very heavily influenced British traditional version. And then the Del McCurry Band can do a bluegrass version using the same melody. And to them, it's not alien. You know, there's still that common link across the Atlantic. Through the Appalachian Mountains. So, yeah, I mean, it's different, but in some ways the same.
You read a lot in the book about touring around in various sort of falling apart vans to these smallish towns around Britain. Did that kind of, as somebody who'd grown up in London, in a rapidly changing London, did that make you feel kind of connected to kind of old England, going to these towns that looked much the same as they would have looked kind of 300 years before?
I'm not sure that they did look the same as they did 400 years before. There are some towns in Britain that are very well preserved, and there are some towns that are kind of fake preserved. A town like Bath is very 18th century. You know, a town like Chester is kind of pretend medieval, but it was actually built by the Victorians mostly. I think a lot of what was surprising to us as we started to play outside of London was really, you know, how much of Britain was industrial. You know, if we played in the Midlands, we were playing somewhere like Birmingham, or we played in the Manchester area, there were still so many mill towns, and that those old red brick Victorian mills, similar to the ones that you have in the States, really. And, you know, the steelworks, you know, and the big cooling towers, you know, it was a real industrial landscape that by the 1980s was rapidly changing. You know, the industry went away very, very quickly. Thanks a lot to Margaret Thatcher, I think, more than anything else, as the workforce became cheaper in other countries. A lot of that industry moved away. A lot of the coal industry moved to South America. A lot of the steel industry moved to Southeast Asia. And so that landscape changed very, very quickly. But you know, that would be my main impression of touring the UK in sort of 67, you know, at Fairport, making, you know, small steps outside of London and just entering a world that we'd seen on TV, but we hadn't really visited that much.
That's interesting. You talked earlier a bit about the kind of politics of the folk club scene being quite left wing. Did Fairport think of their music as having a political context or subtext at all?
Well, I think we did. I think we saw it as as music of the underclass, but we didn't really involve ourselves that directly in politics. We were. Yeah, we weren't singing "Ban the Bomb" songs or something.
Right.
The Vietnam War was much less of an issue in the UK than it was in the US. So I think our politics was always left leaning, but we weren't stridently political.
Mm-hmm. The band often lived together, which seems crazy to me. That seems like a completely bonkers way to be a band. Why did you decide to do that?
I think, first of all, because it was a good work environment. And I think the first time that we did it, which was the summer of 69, it was really to develop the next album. And so we thought, well, if we're in close proximity, then that'll save us on having to rent rehearsal space, people traveling long distances. I think at that time, the band was quite far flung. You know, we weren't all living in London. People were all over the place. So it was easier to wake up in the morning and then say, okay, rehearsal at 11, and everybody's there. I only had to walk down the stairs from their bedroom. So in that sense, that was great. And then after that very pleasant experience of the summer of 69, we said, well, let's get somewhere else so that we can kind of continue doing the same thing. And the next place we found was actually a very drafty and cold and unpleasant, and only had one bathroom between about 14 people. So that was less thrilling.
Sure.
But we were there for a year plus, it served its purpose, I suppose. And I'm not sure that I ever did it again after that. After 71, I think I lived in my own world, in my own apartment or house. But it was a good experiment at the time. And perhaps it's something you can do when you're young. I think once you get to a certain age, the inconveniences become mountains rather than molehills.
Mm-hmm. You went on tour in America. I think, was it just one tour of America, or did you do multiple tours with Fairport? I don't remember.
With Fairport, I did two. I did one tour with Ian Matthews. I think I did two tours with Sandy Denny. So in that time period.
As someone who'd grown up on a lot of American music, what was it like kind of meeting America in the flesh?
Interesting. It was always a little different than I'd been expecting, because you listen to records that come from somewhere else and you kind of fantasize about what that world is. Mm-hmm. And, New York was a little, stranger and funkier than I imagined it would be. LA was just like far more spread out than I could imagine any city could possibly be. San Francisco seemed, crazier than I'd been expecting, it was interesting. And also, it was a very political time in America, the late 60s, generationally different. It seemed a very conservative country with a very rebellious youth movement, really. And I think, again, a lot of that was to do with the Vietnam War. And we were kind of coming from another country and looking at it as outsiders, really. And it seemed very, very strange and a little dangerous and a little scary sometimes. But we certainly found ourselves in some situations that seemed uncomfortable.
This is a very lame interview question, but I want to ask it, which is, would you mind telling our listeners what happened while you were in the Detroit airport on tour in America?
Oh, yeah. As I describe in the book, we were on tour with Fairport and we're in the coffee shop in Detroit and we're waiting for our plane. So we're having some breakfast waiting for the plane. And we hear these insults coming from the next booth, you know, like you know, get your hair cut kind of stuff, you know, long haired layabouts, you know, look at those girls, you know, aren't they sweet? All that kind of stuff, you know. So sure. You know, in a sort of, you know, a pronounced, I'd say almost a Southern accent, really. So I kind of peer around the booth, and it turns out to be Buck Owens and the Buckaroos are in the next booth, you know, bad mouthing us. And I was a big Buck Owens fan. You know, I had his records in the UK. I thought he was a wonderful songwriter, you know, great singer. I loved the records. They're just fantastic records. It was a very disturbing thing, really, you know, to be in that situation. And I kind of resolved it in my own way. But you'll have to read the book to find out the punchline to that one.
Okay, fantastic. So you at a certain point decided to leave Fairport. And I guess a question I have about Fairport Convention is, you know, this is a band that I don't think during your tenure in the band had the same lineup on any two records. Like, it seemed like a band that was very volatile in terms of, you know, people coming and leaving and, you know, bands breaking apart and reforming other bands. Are you sort of surprised that Fairport now has, you know, lasted more than 50 years, given that, you know, it seems like in the book, it's on the verge of breaking up at any given moment?
It's a surprise. Yeah, it's a kind of pleasant surprise for me. I think, you know, in the volatile years, well, the fact that we had a, you know, an accident that killed our drummer,
right,
was a real watershed for us. And I think a certain amount of instability came from the as a consequence of that. Really, I think Ashley leaving, Sandy leaving, we were still really suffering from shock, I think, more than anything else, and we were making bad decisions in many ways. After I left the band, I think the band kind of, you know, always kept the same direction, but the personnel did shift. They actually stopped existing, I think, in 79 for a couple of years, and then kind of came back, you know, in 81, I think. You know, for the last few decades, it's been a far more stable lineup, you know, very stable lineup, really. What's the natural life of a band? I really don't know. I think if you get 5 years with the same lineup, you're doing very well. You know, 10 years is a miracle, pretty much. Yeah, I suppose it was pretty volatile at the time.
Mm-hmm. And when you left Fairport, did you have any sense of kind of what would come next?
No, that was the problem, really, for me. Well, I think I left because I wanted to do more writing. I really wanted to establish a kind of writing style, you know, that as we were saying earlier, you know, is that thing between traditional and contemporary, you know. So I did that, and yeah, I wasn't quite sure what I was going to do. I was thinking, well, I'll have to be a guitar player in somebody's band for a while. But then the phone started ringing, and I got offered a lot of session work. So I did that, really, for the next year or two, until I partnered up with my then wife Linda, and we started working as a duo. And then I think our music became much more focused, and our direction was fairly solid. And you know, that was relatively successful.
Yeah, I think your voice and Linda's voice really meshed together in a wonderful way, almost like Johnny Cash and June Carter Cash. Was that something you figured out right away, or did that kind of take some time to figure out how you're going to work as a duo?
Yeah, I suppose, you know, the reason what we worked as a duo was because we were going out with each other. And...
Right. Sorry, I didn't mean to bury the lead there, Richard.
I was working in Sandy's band, so I was away half the time, and Linda was working on her projects, so she was away the other half of the time. So I said, well, how are we ever going to see each other? So, you know, the light bulb went off. Well, you know, perhaps we should be working together. And then we thought, okay, well, how can we do that? What can we do? So I said, well, I've got these songs. We could do these covers, you know, and we'll just play in folk clubs. You know, the money's fairly good. You know, the overheads are very low. And we could survive on that and think about, you know, career and the next step a bit further down the road. So that's really what we did, you know, and the first album that we did together, you know, we'd written enough songs in that period to have an album's worth of songs. And that was the Bright Lights album, which I think I still think it's a good record.
Yeah, I agree. That's I like a lot of your records, but I think that one's probably my favorite. And that album has obvious similarities with the Fairport Convention sound, but there are differences as well. How would you say your goals shifted when you came to write and record that album?
Well, I think I wanted to do a bit more singing. It was great to have Linda there as another voice, who was very good at kind of interpreting songs and finding the right kind of approach to sing a song. So that was good. I've forgotten the question.
It was just sort of about, you know, the musical direction.
I think we were just thinking, well, you know, what works for us, really. We were writing songs that had a certain flavor to them, and really just recording and interpreting those songs live and seeing, you know, what happened next, really. One thing led to another, pretty much.
Yeah. I hope I'm not getting this wrong, but I think that's the album that has Poor Little Beggar Girl, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That song is a really great a song, and almost to me sounds like folk punk, like something that, like, you know, the Pogues or somebody like that would have recorded. When you heard those bands later, did you sort of think, hey, they're doing what we did?
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. I could hear various threads in the Pogues. you can hear a very strong influence from the Dubliners in the Pogues. I don't know anything else. But obviously, there's a bit of Fairport in there that I don't think they ever really acknowledged, but they definitely owed something of a debt to Fairport. When I heard them, yeah, I think what we thought, well, in many ways, we were more punk than they were. You know, we were playing faster, we were playing louder. You know, the they have a snottier attitude than we did, but musically, I think we were as punk or more punk.
Yeah. I'd love to ask you about another aspect of your life that you cover in the book that's less related to music, or maybe less obviously related to music, which is your kind of searches through spirituality. And you mentioned that you'd kind of been, you know, something of a spiritual seeker for a long time. You'd read Zen, Theosophy, kind of other items on the standard, you know, hippie syllabus. But then when you discovered Sufi Islam, that seemed to have kind of struck a deeper chord with you. Why do you think that was?
I don't know. I ask myself that question sometimes. Because it seems, there are various schools of Sufism that spread right across the Islamic world, from Indonesia to Morocco, Algeria in the West. And the strain of it that I always found the most appealing was the Western strain of it. And Morocco is kind of on the same time zone as the UK. It's just, you know, it's a straight shot south. And I think there's a kind of a more of a Western appeal to Moroccan Sufism. So I think that was a real connection for me. But plus I kind of concluded in my naive searching that the Sufis seem to have it down. They seem to have it nailed. They seem to know what was going on. They seem to have the knowledge at that time in history anyway. And so I thought that was something that I should explore more.
Yeah. Did you kind of have specific questions you were looking for the answer to, and you found those answers in Sufism, or was it more you knew that you'd found what you knew what you were looking for when you found it? Does that make sense?
I think it's seeing a connection, seeing that the these people had a knowledge that was handed down, that they weren't making it up. Sometimes with some of the gurus of the 60s and 70s, I thought that these guys are setting themselves up, but they're not really part of a tradition. Certainly true of some of the Indian spiritual leaders. To me, that was important, that you could trace the lineage back, 1,000 years plus. And I just thought that the Sufis I met, who were English, I felt that they had that they embodied something, you know, that they had some nobility of being that I thought, well, that's something that I want for myself. So that's what I was attracted to, I think.
Another obvious connection to me seems to be that the Sufi tradition has always had a deep connection to both music and poetry. Was that something that appealed to you?
I think absolutely, yes. Yes, there's a whole tradition of music in Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, which is called Andalusian music, that comes from the time when the Moors were up in Spain. It's a real science of music, some Indian music is a real science of music. It has definite rules and it does things to you if you listen to it enough. So I found that very interesting and very appealing. The musical aspect, absolutely, yeah. And the poetry aspect, it's beautiful stuff. Music and poetry are like breathing. So there's just a total joy in having those things in your life.
Well, Richard, I've really enjoyed getting to talk to you. I've already taken up a lot of your time, so I'll let you go. But thanks so much for being on New Books in Performing Arts to talk about your wonderful memoir, Beeswing.
Well, thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you, Andy.